From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right
life.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich and his crazy life. Hits, flops, his romance with Sybil Shepherd, the shocking murder of girlfriend Dorothy Stratton, and some epic studio battles along the way. But first, Will Smith stumbles, and can Google predict box office? That and more on the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by guest banterer Kyle Buchanan. He's senior editor for New York Magazine's Vulture.com. John Horn is away this week. And Kyle, a rare stumble for Will Smith. After Earth is going to lose tens of millions of dollars. And this is an actor who had been considered the most bankable star possibly in the world, and who had not come out with an event movie that didn't open at number one in 20 years.
Yeah, it's a big stumble for him and a big stumble for Sony. They're pretty much tied together. In fact, you see Will Smith's face when you drive onto the Sony lot from Men in Black 3, a franchise that's made them bundles of money. And, you know, on paper, this had a lot of elements that looked good for them. Will Smith obviously has a history with the studio, but also his son Jaden made the Karate Kid remake for them, and that made, you know, over $300 million worldwide. So everybody's pointing fingers right now, trying to figure out who's responsible for this collapse.
Of course, M. Night Shyamalan, who had this hugely promising career at one time with Sixth Sense and other hits. This is probably the tail end of a series of disasters for him, the director. He just can't seem to figure it out at this point. I think he's going to have a very tough time getting another big studio movie for the foreseeable future.
And you know, I think that's best. When he's doing these big tentpole movies like The Last Airbender and After Earth, it's just not, you know, playing to any of his strengths.
Yeah, although I think in the aftermath, Shyamalan is, the word being put out there is, you know, this was really Will Smith and he was in charge of everything, which I believe because he conceived of this. He has a story by credit on this movie. He put his son into the movie. So, you know, it would be helpful probably for Will Smith to come back down to earth. He has a next movie at Warner Brothers, a grifter romance movie. Warner has expressed confidence in him and hopefully he'll be that old Will Smith. Turning to another big talent in the movie world, Christopher Nolan, obviously the director of the Batman series that has made so much money for Warner Brothers. He has his next movie set up at Paramount. Interstellar is the name of the project. Warner Brothers is in for half of that movie. And I don't know about you, Kyle. Initially, I just thought, oh, yeah, Warner Brothers, where Christopher Nolan usually does business.
Right.
He kind of brought them along, kept them in the fold. And it turns out it's a lot more complicated than that. And there was a complicated deal between Paramount and Warners.
Yeah, Warner Brothers really wanted in on this movie. He's made almost all of his movies there. He's sort of their golden goose. But in order for Warner Brothers to come in, they had to give up a couple things to Paramount. In fact, they gave up rights to a potential South Park sequel on the big screen and the Friday the 13th franchise. So Paramount now has those for the next 5 years, and they're free to develop those however they'd like.
Yeah, as it turned out, Paramount and Warner Brothers, through quirks of past deals, each had a piece of the rights of a South Park movie and the Friday the 13th Jason movies. So now Paramount has for a period of time both of them. I think the Friday the 13th feels so much in Paramount's wheelhouse, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they had made a Friday the 13th reboot a few years back with Michael Bay's company that did quite well for its low budget. But they didn't make any sequels to it, and part of the problem was it's really hard to get two studios to agree on something. So now that that blockade has been removed, maybe we'll actually see some movement in that franchise.
I mean, maybe somebody else will see it, because I'm not going to go to a Friday the 13th movie, but that could potentially be. I mean, this is a studio that does Paranormal Activity and messes around with genres, so maybe. Now, meanwhile, Google has announced something that would really be sort of extraordinary. Why don't you explain what that is?
Yeah, so there's an analyst at Google who revealed that over the past year, Google has sort of developed this formula to determine opening weekend box office. They use their proprietary information, you know, essentially
everything about you, which we know.
they're looking at how many times you Google the title of a movie, if you're looking for the trailer, if you're clicking on ads having to do with that movie. And then when they combine it with a couple of other factors, you know, how many theaters is a movie going to get released in? They're saying that 4 weeks out, they can project that opening weekend to 94% accuracy.
Yeah, for years now, I've gotten approached by different people who want me to write about something about, oh, you know, I found this secret formula and I know that I can read the tea leaves in my teacup and tell you how the film's going to open. But Google, actually, you know, when they say it, you do pay attention.
You know, usually movie studios rely on tracking firms to tell them how their movies are going to open. But tracking firms are subject to the same vagaries as any polling place, namely, it's really hard to find young people. You know, young people don't have home phones. They're not going to spend all this time taking surveys. So when you have somebody like Google who says, actually, we're really good at reaching plugged in young people, I think that movie studios that normally don't get accurate tracking information for youth skewed films at all have to stand up and take notice.
Yeah, it's not really clear what Google intends to do with this information. I mean, they could probably sell it for big money to the studios, which do tweak their marketing campaigns down to the bitter end and even after a movie opens and try to figure out, you know, how many theaters they want to be in and how long and all of these things. They say they're going to share it with clients. They claim they won't sell it to the studios.
You know, it sounds awfully altruistic of them to say that they're just going to share that information. But it might be a little controversial if they actually did sell it. I mean, wouldn't it feel odd if you decided to Google Man of Steel and you felt that somehow you were immediately padding the wallet of a studio executive just by Googling that?
Every time I Google something these days, I think a few times. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
That's Kyle Buchanan, senior editor from New York Magazine's Vulture.com. You can keep up with us on Facebook. Go to KCRW's The Business. Coming up, legendary filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich. In the early 1970s, filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich was at the top of the Hollywood pyramid. His run started in 1971 with his Oscar-nominated Last Picture Show and continued with the Barbara Streisand, Ryan O'Neill hit comedy What's Up, Doc? Next came Paper Moon, the father-daughter Depression-era picture with Ryan and Tatum O'Neill. She won an Oscar at age 10 for her memorable performance.
Lady, you made a mistake.
Huh? I give you $4.75.
But I give you a $20 bill.
Uh-uh. You give me a $5.
No, ma'am. It was a $20 bill.
You give me a $5 and I give you $4.75.
It was a $20 bill.
Bogdanovich's run ended with his next three movies, all flops. One of those was At Long Last Love, a slight story based on a medley of catchy Cole Porter songs. The unlikely cast included Bogdanovich's girlfriend at the time, Sybil Shepherd, and Burt Reynolds, who was then at the peak of his career. But neither was exactly known for song and dance.
Please be sweet, my chickadee. And when I kiss you, just say to me.
It's delightful.
Mm-hmm, it's delicious.
It's delectable.
It's delirious.
It's the lemon.
It's the limit.
It's the looks.
At Long Last Love didn't get much love when it was released in 1975. Even Bogdanovich didn't care for it much. He considered it to be a largely forgotten part of his past for more than 35 years. But then in 2011, that changed.
Somebody called me and says, At Long Last Love is streaming on Netflix. And I said, oh, really? So I checked it out, and I'm watching it, and I'm saying, where did this, I cut this scene, what's it doing here? And I'm looking at it, and it's scene after scene that either was cut out or was slightly different. And I said, where, this is a completely different version of the movie. The thing is, what was particularly surprising was that it was good. I was
you were like, who made this, huh?
Yeah, who made this? It was pretty good. So I called Sean Belson at Fox, who's in the editorial department. I said, what is this version that's on Netflix? Where did this come from? He said, well, I don't know. I'll check. He gets back to me and says, well, this has been around since the late 70s, like 79, 80. And well, I said, well, who cut it together? It's not my version. It's not neither the released version nor is it the TV version that I cut subsequent to the release version. He said, let me check. Well, we found out that it was probably done by a fellow named James Blakely, who died about 5 years ago. And he was head of Fox editorial for years and years and years. Turns out he was a big Cole Porter fan and had been involved in his youth in musicals as well. So piecing it all together after a while, I came to the conclusion that what happened was he watched us sort of ruining the movie in the cutting process that was frantic and insanely sped up in 74, 75. And he had seen all the dailies and obviously liked it and said, they're ruining this movie, so I think I'll put a version together that should be the way it should be.
And nobody noticed.
No, I didn't. I never knew it at all. And there's a fellow writing a book about me who I called him about this. I said, did you see the Netflix? Where you see? Yeah, that's the one I taped off of Stars years ago. I said, oh, geez. So I called Jim Giannopoulos, who's the chairman of the board at Fox. I know him a little bit. And I told him the story.
He's chairman of the studio, yeah.
Yeah, chairman of the studio, yeah. And I told him this story, and he said, wait a second. Let me get something straight. You're saying there's a version of this picture that exists, and you've never seen it, you had nothing to do with it, and you like it? I said, yeah. He said, that's one for the history books. So we went to Fox, and they decided that they would put it out for me on DVD.
And you didn't mess with it.
I added a minute and a half, and I did a slight alterations to the main title credits. Otherwise, it was his version. Now, his version was very close to the original screenplay, which I wrote. So he was putting it back the way we intended it to be.
And you feel that you lost that under pressure from the studio to deliver a shorter cut or something?
No, the terrible thing is, Kim, that the studio loved the picture because it was a musical, but it was shot the way they did Les Miserables.
Right, you had people singing and
live. What happened was I asked Fox, no such thing existed. I asked them to invent for me some kind of little tiny speaker that would fit in the ear. And they did. They came up with this little apparatus that fit in the ear, and you combed the antenna into your hair. And the electric piano was with the horn turned off so that you could just hear the electrical impulses if you had a speaker in your ear. Then they sang to that, and then subsequently we put the orchestra in. And I was looking for things that would happen, like people breaking up or making a mistake that worked. I wasn't looking for perfection. The studio loved the picture because they were seeing a lot of these scenes, a lot of these songs were shot in one shot. We would do the entire song in one shot and not cover it. That would be the scene. So when they looked at dailies, the executives, they were not seeing pieces that needed to be edited. They were seeing the scene. So they loved it. And they were pushing me to get it out. We had a great booking at the Radio City Music Hall, which in New York, which was in those days the premier place for any kind of family entertainment. So they were rushing me to get it out for this date. And, the version that opened was the worst version that existed.
Because of the rush.
Yeah. Now, and then I recut it, and it wasn't that much better. And for years, people would come up to me, and they'd say, we saw it on television, and why did it get such bad reviews? We thought it was very charming and fun. And I said, well, that's not the version that opened. That's the version I cut afterward. Well, it turns out it wasn't the version I cut afterward. It was this James Blakely version. I think the lesson to be learned is if you wait long enough, you know, something good will happen, even with the worst picture you've made. I remember when I showed it to Sybil, she cried and she said, it's like having a child that was mutilated and returned to you whole.
Wow, that's pretty emotional.
Yeah, well, it was emotional for us at the time. We put a lot into it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich. His 1975 musical, At Long Last Love, is now out on Blu-ray. And it's not quite the same as the theatrical version that Variety called a disappointing and embarrassing waste of talent. The film was the second of three consecutive flops that brought Bogdanovich's once red-hot career to a screeching halt. Bogdanovich acknowledges that his original cut of At Long Last Love didn't work, but he still doesn't think the film deserved such a negative response from critics and the public. He attributes that reaction to his off-screen romance with Sybil Shepherd, who had made her acting debut in his 1971 film The Last Picture Show. The affair that began then led Bogdanovich to leave his wife and two young daughters.
You couldn't open a magazine or a newspaper in the mid-70s without reading something nasty about us.
Why?
And Cary Grant called me up one day and he says, Peter, will you for Christ's sake stop telling people you're happy?
That's it. They were.
And stop telling them you're in love. Why, Cary? Because they're not happy and they're not in love. I thought all the world loves a lover. No, don't you believe it.
So you think it was just that you were too much of an it couple, basically?
Yeah, we just got on people's nerves, I think.
Billy Wilder, you know this quote? This is the quote. It isn't true that Hollywood is a bitter place divided by hatred, greed, and jealousy. All it takes to bring the community together is a flop by Peter Bogdanovich. Do you remember when in your life that quote was uttered?
That was around Sybil. That was around At Long Last Love.
What?
Well, Billy was great at kicking people when they were down.
That's not the picture I think probably people have of director.
Well, they didn't know him.
He was
really not a very nice person.
Were you hurt by that?
No, I just consider the source, you know.
It's kind of funny because, you know, in more recent years, there's been this people complaining. I mean, we had Ben Affleck on the show, and he talked about the period in his life when he was involved with Jennifer Lopez, and there was constant tabloid coverage. And he felt that it was, you know, it demystified him as an actor. And
he's right.
You seem to have had the early version of that.
Yeah, definitely. It was we were definitely stigmatized.
How did you cope with that?
I just stopped reading magazines and newspapers for about 20 years.
You also stopped making movies for a period of time.
No, I made another picture right after that called Nickelodeon.
Oh, right, which did not do well also.
It did all right. It just wasn't, it wasn't what I wanted. It was compromised.
Again, a studio thing, a time pressure
that
thing?
That one was a studio argument with the head of the studio. That was David Beagleman. He sort of screwed that movie up for me. I really wanted to shoot it in black and white, and he wouldn't let me. And even though I'd had two hits already in black and white.
Last Picture Show
and Paper Moon.
Paper Moon, right.
But anyway, he was a pain in the neck. So that picture was compromised, and I said, you know, the hell with this. I'm not going to make pictures for a little while. I'm going to go to Europe and think about what went wrong.
What did you conclude?
That I had compromised, and I shouldn't have. And I'd been led down the garden path. And my own fault, I should have done what I wanted to do, and I should have said to Fox, I know we like the movie, but it isn't right. Let's not release it until it's right. And with Nickelodeon, I should have said, I'm not going to make the movie unless I can do it in black and white, and unless I can have exactly the cast that I want, and so on and so forth. But I didn't.
Were you not in a position of strength at that point?
I was in a position of strength, but you sort of get bitten by success, and then you don't want to let it go, and you forget your integrity. And so Sybil and I went around the world twice, and I didn't make a picture for about, I guess, 2 or 3 years.
Coming up after a short break, the darkest period in Bogdanovich's life, plus his plans to shoot a movie produced by Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker, actor, and author Peter Bogdanovich, whose career has been marked by great highs and traumatic lows. In 1980, he was involved in a romance with 20-year-old Dorothy Stratton. She was Playboy Playmate of the Year and had left her husband for Bogdanovich. He directed her in a film, They All Laughed, which also starred Audrey Hepburn and Ben Gazzara. But months later, Stratton was brutally murdered by her estranged husband, who then killed himself. The story was dramatized in two films, including Bob Fosse's 1983 movie Star 80 with Mariel Hemingway. Bogdanovich says he watched that picture on behalf of Stratton's mother and sister Louise.
So I went to see it because we had to sue them, Warner Brothers. And they actually ended up paying Louise and Nellie, her mother, about $150,000. And they took a couple of lines out of the picture and so on. That was hell, seeing that.
I can't imagine watching that. It's just horrible.
Well, it was such a bad movie, too.
Stratton's murder changed the course of Bogdanovich's life. He spent 3 years writing a book about her, and there was more terrible publicity. Hugh Hefner accused Bogdanovich of seducing Stratton's younger sister, Louise, when she was 13. Louise responded with a libel suit that she then dropped. Some years later, Bogdanovich married Louise when she was 20 years old and he was 49. In the wake of Dorothy Stratton's murder, the grief-stricken Bogdanovich had made the unusual and risky decision to distribute They All Laughed, the one and only film he made with her, on his own.
That was a terrible mistake. I was crazy. I was completely crazed after she was killed. Fox was going to release the picture, and I said, I don't want you to release the picture because you guys don't believe in it, so I'll just buy it back from you and I'll release it myself. And United Artists wanted to release it, and there were a couple of other people who wanted to release it, and Columbia wanted to do a record. And I just said, no, 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 and I didn't trust anybody. And I just said, I'll do it myself, and I lost my shirt.
I think you ended up with bankruptcy.
Eventually, yeah.
So how much of that was grief, and how much of that was previous experience in this business?
No, previous experience in this business had something to do with it, but really I was irrational. I was just not functioning on all cylinders. I was just screwed up and made a lot of mistakes, and there was nobody there to say, Peter, don't do this. You don't spend your own money on this.
And then you wrote the book. I
wrote the book before the bankruptcy.
But Hugh Hefner sued you?
No, we sued him because he accused me of having an affair with Dorothy's younger sister.
Yeah, that was a big scandal of the day.
At the time, it was a scandal, yeah.
And there were also rumors that you had had her have surgery so she would look like her sister. I mean, I know you said that's not true.
No, it's absolute What happened was when Louise was born, she was premature, and they had to put a breather in her mouth and pulled her jaw out of place. And when she was older, it got very noticeable and it was not attractive, and she was very unhappy about it. So we took her to a dental surgeon, and he gave her braces and did a whole thing, and eventually had an operation that just put her jaw back in place.
I'm not asking just to relive the horrible events of your life, but if you were being reviled during the Sybil thing, you must have been like the reviling on steroids with rumors that you were having this teenage girlfriend and getting her plastic surgery to look like her sister.
Yeah, it was all just garbage. What actually happened was, we were both asked about this subsequently. It was like we'd been a shipwreck, and we both ended up holding on to the same piece of driftwood. And we were family, and we became lovers eventually, when she got older. We're dealing with all the crap in my life here.
We're coming full circle. I'm going in a direction, believe it or not, not necessarily in a linear fashion.
Oh, that's okay.
You made Mask.
Right.
Was that like the comeback? But it ended up once again with an argument.
Yeah, I had a big argument with the studio on that one, too, yeah.
This was about the music. You wanted to use Springsteen music?
I had Bruce Springsteen at the time, just to refresh your memory about that moment in time. He had the biggest album in the history of albums, Born in the USA. And he hadn't let anybody use his music for a movie. And I knew him, and he liked my stuff, and we were friends. And I said, I'd like this kid in Mask, the real kid, Rocky Dennis, was a big fan of yours, and I'd like to use your music in the picture. And he said, okay. And I had his hit songs like Badlands, Thunder Road. And
normally those are, just ridiculously expensive to license.
He wouldn't let anybody, even for money, do it, So it was a big coup, and it was truthful to the character. So when the studio made it impossible for me to use the music, and it was largely the head of the studio at the time.
Who was that?
This was Frank Price.
Oh, Frank Price.
Frank put a kibosh on it.
This was at Universal. And why did Frank put the kibosh on it?
I think the reason was because they had a picture that he had nothing to do with Mask. The picture was greenlit before he came on the scene. So he had nothing to do with it. And he had a lot to do with a picture called Out of Africa. And he thought that they're both based on true stories, he just thought ours would be a more powerful picture. And it was. So he made sure it wasn't.
Sabotage is the accusation.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was sabotage, no question about it.
Do you go back and talk to whoever was running it? I mean, MCA's changed hands, it's not
even
called
Ron Meyer was there.
He's still there,
and he was a friend of mine. But it was because of Bruce. He had seen the version, and he loved it. He said, I love the way you used my music. So I said to Bruce, look, you know, it's been 20 years. Do you think we could figure out a way to use the music in the picture? And he and John Landau, his partner, and they said, look, if it has to be for nothing, you can have it for nothing.
That's a very rare in this world.
It's unheard of.
Yeah.
So I called Ron Meyer and I told him. Ron said, write me a letter. So I wrote him a letter and
It was done.
So
you've been pretty patient about talking about, as you put it earlier, all this crap. But the reason I'm asking is you have a career that has had a lot of ups and downs, obviously, and a lot of arguing with studios, lawsuits. If somebody says to you, are there two or three big lessons that you have learned from this? What are they? And this is
don't
this
sue the studio.
That's one.
Don't sue the studio and don't distribute yourself. That's two.
And in terms of just the personal
and
stuff.
And don't start talking about how much you love somebody.
Oh, that's a sad one.
Yeah, just shut up about it. That's three rules that I can come up with from my vast experience.
Are you going to do this film? Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach, I guess, have talked about Squirrels to the Nuts.
Squirrels to the Nuts, yeah. Wes and Noah are two of the producers of it. I love Wes and I love Noah. I think they're very, very gifted. I asked them if they would produce this film for me, and they agreed to do it, and it's been a big help.
Is it a thing?
Yeah, we start shooting in July 15th in New York with Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston and Sybil Shepherd and Eugene Levy and Jason Schwartzman and a few others.
I mean, you have an oeuvre that is recognized, and obviously some of these films were hugely respected. Do you feel that you need a comeback?
Well, I don't know about need a comeback. I just want to make another few pictures before they take me off to the big screening room in the sky. I'd like to make a few pictures, and this is one that Louise Stratton and I wrote when we were married, and then we've rewritten it since we got divorced. But we're very close. I mean, she's my best friend.
Peter Bogdanovich is a filmmaker, actor, author, and blogger. The Blu-ray of his 1975 film, At Long Last Love, is now available. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from J.C. Swadek. Listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW mobile app. And find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.